Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm Heidi. I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. And I'm truly humbled that you think I saved your life. And it really is only through the grace of God and my willingness to hear the voice of God and, answer the call. And I hope to be able to share that with you a little bit. But, you know, Christy says that I saved her life, but really it was just about the willingness to understand all of the steps and understand what God has done for me. And it's not my responsibility, but it is my gift and my privilege and my honor to share it to another human being. So with that said, thank you for the committee that allowed me to speak today. I was invited in 2020 to speak, and it was canceled. So it's been a long time to get to this point. I'm kind of excited to finally get it over. You know, I've kind of gone through moments of crazy, you know, nervousness, and then I've just done a lot of prayer for you of who ended up here in the seats. And that's one of the things that the program taught me is to pray. And I pray a lot now because it helps me not to think of myself so much. And it's hard for me to share my spiritual journey because I have some age on me. I've got, 53 years to share with you. And I can't sum all that up, and I can't quantify it effectively because I can't quantify the power of what God has done, but I hope you see it in me. I hope you see it in my actions. I hope you see it in my words. I'll share a little bit about my using. And I want to share a little bit more about after, because that's where it really all started for me. But I was born in the late 60s, and I love hearing other people's stories because, you know, it's vastly different than mine. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and we had different living then. And I grew up in a small town, and you know, if you grew up in a small town, you might be able to relate, but, you know, my family didn't have to keep tabs on me. You know, we'd go ride our bikes, we'd go to the grocery store and take quarter and walk out with 25, you know, pieces of candy. You know, it's just different living. And I was born to two parents that were inherently selfish, and I was a result of them getting divorced and fighting over me. Fighting over us. I had three sisters who are a huge support to me. They're kind of my go-tos a lot. Later, after my family was divorced, my father got remarried and I inherited three brothers, stepbrothers. And so to try and quantify, you know, what life was, I didn't really live on the streets. I didn't have that rough, tough mentality. And, you know, living in a small town, I was raised Catholic. And, you know, because of the program, I got to make sense of that later. And I won't go too far into religion, but because I don't want to step over the boundaries of tradition, but, you know, I'm okay with religion, but that was the gift of the program is, you know, God led me to the program so I could sit in that seat because I deserved to sit in that seat. I earned it. And I got to sort a lot of stuff out, and I got to sort a lot of stuff out about the Catholicism that I was raised under. And when I walked into the program, I wasn't real happy about all that. I was kind of mad and resentful and confused about all those rules. And what I realized was I just didn't fit. My parents were raising me without knowing they were raising an addict. And they weren't equipped with that. I had different thinking all the time. I had excessive thinking. I was obsessed a lot about a lot of different things. And they didn't know that. And I didn't tell them. So, you know, there's that, you know, imbalance there. And, you know, cocaine kind of started making its name in the 80s. And I won't go into the politics of it, but I always thought it was ironic that they declared a war on drugs, you know. And a war has a beginning and an end, you know. And it really did change the dynamics of our society. And, you know, back then, if you were doing cocaine, you were rich. You know, there was a stigma, and that's the stigma became, you know, oh, you're a drug addict. Well, most of my family members drank, And it was okay to drink, but don't be doing drugs. That was taboo. So I hid it. I became a very good liar, is what that was. You know, society had a lot of that. You know, and then that slogan they came up with is just say no. I could never grasp that. Just say no to what? You know, what was I? Drugs? No way. I loved, if I could have successfully figured out how to do drugs, I'd still be doing them, but I couldn't. I couldn't. Right? Everybody's kind of like, yeah, exactly. And my parents got divorced and separated, and that was a change. I don't like change that's inflicted by others. I learned that as a result of the programs. If a change is inflicted by me, I get to control it, and I have an easier time with it. And there are moments in my life that I had, I call them soul wounds, trauma. You may relate to that word better. Divorce, being taken back from my mother. When my father got married, we had to go live with him. And that was, you know, kind of the first feeling of abandonment. I couldn't process that. I didn't understand all that then. But I used to avoid sharing my story because I had kind of a simple life. But in my mind, it was kind of complex because of the things that happened. I just couldn't process them. But I had simple living. You know, we'd go swimming all the time in this, you know, and, you know, from the time the swimming pool opened, and we had to be home by the time the church bells rang, you know, because if you weren't home by the time the church bells rang, you were in trouble, and that was just a rule, because we had to cook and clean and, you know, do our nightly chores and whatnot. And then in the summertime, we had to be home by the time the street lights were on. That was the guideline. And, you know, my dad used to say, pay attention to when sundown was. You know, it's going to start changing over the seasons. If you're not home, you're in trouble. You know, and he raised us strictly. And, you know, my sisters and I used to think we were poor, but we weren't poor. But we used to think we were poor because we had to eat leftovers, and he made us wear Wrangler jeans. And, you know, I mean, we were just like, oh, no, we can't. Oh, no. But it wasn't like that. And I had a lot of religious influence. I had a grandmother that was very religious, and that's not to any fault of her own, but I was blessed because she was spiritual as well. So I had that guide. I didn't come into the program not having a concept of God. I didn't have that, the quandary. The only quandary I had was that I know I had done wrong. I had spent years becoming the person that I wasn't supposed to be, and that guilt and that shame just shied me away, and that was my only problem with God, is because I knew I had really screwed up. And I started drinking, and you know, I'm used to going to turkey shoots, and you know, going to the KFC hall for big weddings, and it was normal for my family to be drinking. I didn't know. If you're raised in it, you didn't know that that wasn't the norm. I mean, everybody had a beer or, you know, a drink in their hand. So it was okay. And I started drinking about 14. And by the time I was 18, when I went away to college, I tried cocaine for the first time. And that was it. That was my drug of choice. When I figured out that I could drink, vomit, drink, cocaine, I was set. And then on the second time I did cocaine, it was crank back then. And that's just nasty coke. It's just nasty coke. It's yellow. And it is not good. And that was the first time I had a bad trip. And the girl with me, she didn't want to take me to the hospital because she didn't want to tell anybody what it was, because she was afraid of getting in trouble. I spent 24 hours in the shower, just sitting there, shaking, vomiting in my own self, just begging somebody, take me to the hospital. No, you're fine, you're fine. We can't go to the hospital. They'll know. And that was not easy. It was the first time I hallucinated. And I don't really share this a lot. I share it intimately with my sponsees, but I was dark after that. I saw Satan, and there was no doubt about what I saw. And there were times in my life over the next couple of years that I wasn't a Satan worshiper, but I was dark. And I lived in the darkness. It's like over on the other side of the veil. You know, you're just right on the other side of the veil. People are talking to you like, hey, maybe you ought to fix your life. Maybe you ought to not do, you know, maybe you ought to go to work on time. Maybe you ought to shower. You know, you're just, you can, it's like it's muffled, you know. You know you should, but you can't really, you know, do it. You know what I'm talking about. So I spent the next couple of years just kind of off and running. And the other problem I struggled with, you know, sharing it, my story was I had a lot of good times. And I didn't really know that I could, you know, share that I had good times. It wasn't all bad. I mean, there were, obviously, it wasn't all that good because I spent the duration, so much duration of becoming somebody who I wasn't. But I partied like a rock star. I mean, we traveled. I mean, my family still to this day doesn't understand how I didn't have a job from like 3 or 4 years in my early 20s. And I'm like, it was so easy. What do you mean have a job? What? And they were like, what did you do? I traveled. I was Grateful Dead, you know. I went to concerts. I hung out with people. And back then, we didn't have, you know, we didn't have gangs. We didn't have, you had to be tough and, you know, act like you were from the street. We just all were, you know. We all used to hang out at Central and Tyler. It used to be the original 4-H building. Back then, the cops would let you hang out and be okay with it. And they'd come up and talk to you and, hey, you guys, you know, keep it down, you know, just, you know, be mellow. And we would, you know. And we'd hang out at the across the street at the bar, Burger King. And that was in high school. And you know, I made a lot of mistakes during that time, though. I was a hellion. My senior year, I went to Bishop Carroll, and I was kicked out, me and two other girls. It was three of us, but the other one got to stay because her family was heavily affiliated with tithing and the politics of the church. And it didn't teach me anything because I went back to my small town where I only had to take 3 hours a day to graduate, so I'd go there, and then I'd go pick up my girls at high school, and we'd be off and running. And, you know, the very first time I used, I got blackout drunk, and you would have thought that, you know, would have stopped me, but it didn't. It fueled something inside of me, you know, the obsession of the mind and the craving. And I went through long periods where I'd maintain it. I was pretty high functioning. It's because I loved fun. And I was that girl that at the end of the night, I didn't want to go home. So what'd we do? Hey, y'all want to go get tattoos? Sure, let's go get tattoos, you know, or hey, you want to go do something else? And that's what we would do. We would party from Tuesday through Sunday and have a rest day. And I can't even tell you how many concerts I went to out of town. Somebody would just be sitting around saying, you want to go out of town? Sure, let's go, you know. And that's how I spent most of my life. And then about the age of, I had another traumatic experience. I have a broken picker, you know. You put a bad boy in the room and I'm going to spot him like that. I was like, oh, he looked at me. I'm in love. It's just God's will for me. No, it's not. And God did not send me that married man. Very big regrets. But I had to come to honesty later. And I really screwed up that step three for a long time. And I'll get to that in a little bit. But I dated a guy, and he wasn't real nice. But that's how spiritually sick I was. And I used to point my finger at him. He was mean. He was this. And he would hit me. No. It was pointed out to me that I was spiritually, emotionally sick. And I hated myself. And I thought I deserved it. And I continually put myself around that kind of person because it fed something in me. It solidified that I was bad. And that was on me. That wasn't on him. My sponsor and the people in this program, my tribe, all of you. Because I spent so many years just feeling out of place, you know, whether it was school or any social environment, I just was missing something. And you know, the gratitude that I have that I finally hit rock bottom, that God put me to the rooms. Because it's like, whoo-wee, where y'all been? I've been out here trying to survive alone, you know? You got me. You understood me. I was finally home when I finally crawled into AA, you know? But that guy, he taught me a lot. I tried to break up with him, and he played Russian roulette with me. He loaded a gun, and he spun the barrel. And when I wouldn't take off my clothes for him, he shot the gun at me. One, two, three, on and on and on. There were six. In six rounds, he shot the gun in my forehead. I lost so much dignity. Ooh, I lost so much dignity. I was madder than all mad at him, but it was, for the longest time, is all of his fault. All of his fault. And I was giving all my power away, you know? I was giving all my thoughts to him. I became afraid of him, and it consumed me. I moved away to college, and that's when I started doing more drugs, more cocaine. And it took me a long time to get over that. And it took a long time for me to accept the fact that I got kicked out of high school. And I failed my first year in college. Go figure. I started cocaine. Well, who can manage cocaine and try and stay in college? Because I didn't do anything in small amounts. I did it big, you know? Yeah. And I grew up in a time period where, you know, our parties were different back then. You know, everybody shared their drugs. You know, now it's a little bit different. Y'all got stingy, you know? You know, I went to parties where it was just, there wasn't a worry about somebody having a gun or a girl sizing me up and, you know, looking me up and down. We just partied. We just had a good time. Big old lines of cocaine everywhere in the room. And, you know, you ever see that movie Hangover, you know, where they wake up with the animals, you know, and I thought that was about me, you know, because there were a couple times I wake up in strange places. There's a goat walking across the room. I'm like, where in the hell am I at? You know, and I'm not proud of it, but, you know, I was pretty loosey-goosey with men, you know. I loved men. It's like, oh, you pay attention to me. I didn't really ever want you to get to know me, though. I was just like I wasn't in it for the commitment. I was not interested in you liking me for long term. Although that is what I desired, but I sure wasn't going to allow it. So, at the age of 21, another life soul wound was my grandmother died. She had been just a rock in my life. And she taught me so much, and my mother did the same. I had problems with my mother when I got sober. I had to go resolve those. I'm grateful that that happened. After she died, after my grandmother died, nobody taught me how to deal with my emotions, and it wasn't helping the fact that I was using. So from the age of 14 to 27-ish, I was supposed to be growing up. I was supposed to be learning the principles because of life experiences. And I see that in my three children. I have three children. I'm a single mother. And I see them growing as life has taken them through experiences. Now they don't use and they don't drink, but I see them learning courage through life experiences. Well, I missed out on that, and I couldn't go right to the Bible. I was raised Christian. I couldn't go right to the Bible because it was like drinking from a fire hose, trying to, you know, grasp all that, and I couldn't. My thinking was so distorted, and I believed my delusion. You know, somebody said it in one of the speeches, and it was, when I started to believe the delusion more than I started to believe reality, I call that hell. Because I started to believe that I had to use to function. And I started to believe that I couldn't drive without it. I had to use to take a shower. I had to use to clean the house. I had to use to go to work. And that's hell for me. When the delusion became real, because that's when it got the grips of me. And it got the grips of me both times. I relapsed. I had 5 years. I stood up here last night for 17 years. I have 17 years on the 24th of October. Thank you. And he said, Troy said, I couldn't pay it forward. I was like, whoops, I got to go sit down. I'm only 16 years for another couple of weeks. But I walked into my first treatment when I was 27 years old. And from the age of 21 to 27, I don't remember a lot. I have patches where I remember. And I used to save all my bills in a box, and I had to move home with my dad, and that was the first time I lived with my father since I was 12. And I was scared to death moving in with him because I didn't know him. I had to get to know him again, because the best thing my mother ever said to me was no. Parenting is not easy. I do it. And I wore my mama out. I did. And when I got sober, she said, nope, no more, no more. And that saved my life. You may not want to tell your children no, but that no may have been painful for her, but woo-wee, it was good for me. So, anyway, 27 years old, and I'm getting sober, and fellowship was different back then. We still carry the message now, but in AA and CA and even NA, they should have had a social calendar for it. I mean, bingo, dances, swimming parties. I mean, it was just something every weekend and every night. And I walked into AA by accident in 1992, and I sat in there because I was dating this guy. Another dysfunctional relationship, and he had gotten sober, and I love how it works, you know, it's the subtleties, you know. He was getting sober, and I started hearing things slowly, just a little bit, but I kept shutting that. I was like, nope, I'm not ready, nope. I had to go down my own destructive path to get ready. But I go into an AA meeting thinking I'm in an Al-Anon meeting, and I realize I'm over at the old dog pound over for renewal at Central and Ridge, and I'm sitting there, and there's a bunch of old guys, old geezers, old timers, and I was like, I look over at this guy, I said, is this an AA meeting? He goes, yeah, honey. I go, oh, I'm not supposed to. Where's the Al-Anon meeting? He goes, it was an hour ago upstairs. And so I got up to leave, and the guy goes, you'll be back. We'll keep a seat for you. How'd he know that? You know? And that pissed me off. Ooh, that made me mad. I was like, I'm not coming back. What are you talking about? Well, I did. I came back crawling. I sobered up, and I had $25,000 in immediate debt. I loved to shop. I loved to steal. Ooh, I became a thief. We didn't have metal detectors. You know, we didn't have the little beeper things on the, you know, clothes. Stealing was like second nature to me. I had to really look at that when I got sober. Kind of goes along with my obsessive compulsive behavior, you know. And let's see, where was I at? So at 27, I got sober, and then I ended up staying about a year sober and found a guy. Oh, I just thought it was God's will for me. And you know, I don't know if it was God's will for me, but I ended up marrying him and having three children with him. And I was sober probably about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, and 4 years. And I slowly stopped going to meetings. And I'd worked the steps. I'd gone through Sis B from Renewal, wonderful woman, God rest her soul. And she had worked the steps with me. I gave her my fifth step in treatment. And it was a layer. It was a layer to the multi layers that I had built over the years of 14 years of doing drugs and alcohol. And it's, you know, working the steps is, it's not just about writing them out. It's not just about and it's sitting in the seat I learn more from the people in the program, whether it's taking a big book study or having somebody take you through the book, or just getting together and reading with people. It's the fact that I started coming and staying. And then when I relapsed, I was driving home instead of going to the meetings. And my support system at the time, you know, my ex-husband, you know, I don't blame him. He didn't really support that I was an alcoholic or an addict. He didn't really want to hang out with my friends. And that's not real healthy for me. I need a good support system. I know that now. So I'd tell myself, yeah, I'm kind of tired. I don't need to go to a meeting. I'm kind of tired. I don't want to go do my step work. You know, and that slow creep, you know, I knew I should be doing it, but I didn't. I knew I should be going, and I started believing that I didn't need it. And that's how the relapse started. And I picked up just like that. And at first, I was just drinking alcohol, and my husband at the time had lost his job, and we had to go down from two incomes to one, and that was a lot of pressure on me. In the same time, I was having babies, and I didn't take the time I needed for the second child because I needed to get back to work because we needed the income. And I had some postpartum set in that was just not recognized. And there was a relapse right after that. And I got the job of all jobs, a job I had always wanted to have. And that did not help my ego. It did not help it at all. And I just kind of thought I was invincible at that point. Well, they taught me I was not. I lost 75% of my job in the middle of October, the year I got sober. And 6 weeks before that, I had got on a motorcycle out in Granola, Kansas. And my kids were there and a couple other young kids. Got on a motorcycle and wrecked. And I toppled over seven times and about killed myself, shattered my face. And I shouldn't have been doing that. But, you know, that grandiose thinking is I can do it. Well, that was just, you know, back to living in the hell. I also call it a hell loop. You know, you shouldn't be doing it, but you do it over, and then it becomes, you know, you're just so, you know, that magnet where you're just, you want to stop, but you can't stop. And that's that hell loop for me. And I laid on the bed, you know, for 6 weeks, and by the time I finally walked into treatment, I was bent over physically. Physically, I was bent over because I had laid in bed and I had a knee brace and I had the weight of the world on my shoulders. I was up to $800 a week cocaine usage and I caused my family bankruptcy. And it was probably the reason why my husband later said that he couldn't forgive me. That was on him, not me. It's understandable. I was not a good wife. I desire to be a better person and a better wife someday if God chooses that. But I had to reconcile all that. We stayed married for a couple more years, and later on, we ended up divorced. I put him through hell. I did. I put my children through hell, but they were young. And by the grace of God, there go I. And I've been able to raise my children on the program. And if they ever ended up in the program, they'll be real pissed off because that's how they were raised. They know all the little sayings. I'm like, I told them, just keep it simple. Keep it simple, you know. And I tell them, to thine own self be true. And I'd have to tell them so I would hear it, you know. And it helped me be a better parent, you know. And I'd tell them, perseverance. Do your perseverance step today. And those were the principles, you know. And my first year of sobriety was not easy. I was 28 days sober and I was going back to work. And I've been at the same company for 24 years. And I got this job when I was in my first round of sobriety. And my first day back after I had relapsed, they gave me a last chance memo, and they basically said, you blink wrong and you're gone. Well, I was still the only person earning income at the time, So that was a lot of pressure. That was a lot of pressure on me. The downside of that is when, right before I relapsed, I was justifying it. Well, I'm the only one earning the income. I can go do what I want. I'm the only one working. I deserve to stop off at the bar and have a drink before I go home. And that justified my behavior in my finances as well. And the second time I sobered up, I was $25,000 plus in debt and caused my family bankruptcy. I'm a big spender when I'm drunk and wasted. I love to, you know, write hot checks, steal. I didn't steal from individuals, and that was my, you know, justification, but I steal from stores. And my financial restitution is long and vast and ongoing, and it's just now called tithing is what it's called. So I was about 6 months into it, and still going to meetings, and I'd just go to meeting, and I'd go to work and go home and try and take care of the kids a little bit, and that's all I could do. You know, it was pointed out to me that I wasn't bad getting good. I was sick getting well. And if I needed a nap, I needed a nap. If I needed some quiet time, that was okay. You know, I never had put myself in the position where I put my needs healthy in there and set healthy boundaries, because I was always becoming somebody you wanted me to be. And that's how I spent my life. I was like trying to be daddy's good girl or mommy's good girl, and it never worked. I never really fit anywhere until I got into the rooms and it was like, hey, I'm finally home. Because I could share my story and you would relate to it. You would tell my story. And I didn't have that out there. I was just constantly looking. I was severely codependent. I required humans for my validation. Not just male codependent. I was female codependent. I needed people, because for me to be alone was for me to live in another hell. I hated to be alone. And as long as I was doing something or around someone, then I could avoid looking at the shallowness inside of me and all the sickness. And my first year was not easy. I would say it was a real test of perseverance. About 15 days after I was back to work and out of treatment, my father-in-law got diagnosed with a terminal brain tumor, brain cancer, and in the first year he passed away. I had another miscarriage, and I'm trying to maintain work and maintain sobriety, and it was a difficult time. And I didn't start the steps until 9 months. I was going to New Life. Originally, my home group was Renewal over at Central and Ridge. And then I started doing Cocaine Anonymous a little bit. And New Life was closest to my house. And I started going there. And Bobo, if anybody knows Bobo, he comes up to me and says, are you ever going to stop crying and start working those steps? And I'm like, maybe I should do something now, you know. So I started working with a sponsor. And it was pointed out to me many things. You know, the promises, you know, we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I didn't really realize it, but the minute I got honest, the minute I finally just said, I can't do it, I'm in debt, I'm in trouble, I can't quit, that was the gateway to my new freedom and my new happiness. And since then, it's just gone on and on and on since then. And let me see what time it is so I don't go on and on. Later on in sobriety, I started hearing more about the principles. I didn't hear very much about the principles in the early days of sobriety. And I started thinking, yeah, what are those principles, you know? And I worked through the steps the long way, and it was pointed out to me that I can incorporate those steps in my daily life. And it wasn't until step 10 where my sponsor taught me to do a spot check, and it was the more self-restraint of tongue and thought and actions, the better I'm going to be. And the promises came true for me when I started to incorporate that in my daily life. And sometimes that was every minute. Because I'd like to tell you what your problem was, because then it means I didn't have to face me. So for me to restrain was painful, to me to shut my mouth, because I used to walk in a room and I thought you had to notice me, because that was just how insecure I was. I was so mentally, emotionally, and spiritually sick. I was an attention whore. And if I wasn't getting your attention, I would sure damn well make sure I had it by the time it was all over with, you know? And so honesty, the principle of honesty, you know, at first it was, I worked a step of how I became powerless and how I couldn't quit. But honesty to me, to this day, I can easily ask myself, is my thinking and my feet in the same spot? You know, am I doing what I'm saying I'm doing? I can work the principle of honesty in any moment of my day. And I find it so fascinating that I avoided trying to go further down, like to hit my bottom. I did anything to avoid hitting my bottom, not just once, but twice in my life. And that was the most freeing moment, because that was the first time where the delusion wasn't ever taking over. I was no longer believing it. And I was like, I can't do it. Get me out of here. I'll do whatever it takes. And those were honest moments. Those were the first honest things I had said in years. And I would say, I would do anything. Just get me out of where I was at. And learning the concept of being sober, you know, and giving up all that fun, I really had to retrain my thinking of what fun was, you know. And fun was the first time I experienced a new peace. That's another promise. You know, and the feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear after I learned the steps, and especially starting pointing out the principles when they were started to be pounded down my throat. And it was, just have honesty and hope and faith inside of you. Where are you at with your faith, Heidi? Are you living in God's will, or are you really, you know, are you pushing the angst? Are you trying to push the envelope? And up until, God, even 12 years of my sobriety, I was still being willful. I mean, I would really have a good ability to manipulate that. Oh, it's God's will for me. You know, oh, I'm just sure that that guy came into my life. I just know God brought him here. I just know that I'm supposed to go do this other, you know, thing. Or, you know, I'm just know I'm supposed to spend all this money. I just know that God gave me this money to go spend all that money. No, that was just lip service. Yeah, I was just fooling myself. And, they say that we're an onion. We have many, many layers. And over 17 years, and even those other five that I had in sobriety, I've learned so much. Step seven talks about humility, the principle of humility. I had two life earth-shattering moments where God just blatantly showed me humility. I had to learn it. You know, my sponsor gave me that exercise of, if you're in a room, don't talk about yourself. If you're sitting there, I, you know, that was painful. I couldn't have a conversation with anybody because I couldn't see you long enough. I had to talk about me. I ache. Oh, I'm sad. Oh, I'm tired. Blah, blah, blah. I just oozed with it. And it was pointed out to me in treatment when I went in 2004 that I was not gangster. I was not ghetto. I was trying to be, but I was foul. That's how I was described. I was foul and vulgar is how they described me. And that was earth-shattering to me. I was like, oh, me? No way. Are you kidding? Well, I had become that. I had become foul. And every other word was a cuss word. And when I got sober, I just sat a lot of times and I would just hold myself and, it was like the demons were coming out of me. I don't ever want to get sober again, because I don't ever want to have to go through that again. That last drunk, you'll know, that last time you got sober, you'll know you're done, because it scares me to get sober again. I don't think I could do it. I can go out and use again, but I sure don't think I can get sober again. The humility. The good Lord will walk you through it. If you aren't learning it, it's okay. Just be willing. Be willing. be willing to walk through the principles and be willing to accept the principles that he is trying to walk you through. The first time I had a dose of it was when I was in treatment. My counselor used to give me a Kleenex box because I couldn't sit. And I was so angry. Ooh, I was angry at everybody and and husband and kids and mom and dad and just pointing. And he tried to tell me three times, Heidi, I have something to tell you. I kept kicking that box. And I kick it against the wall. And he goes, Heidi, stop. I have something to tell you. At that moment, it was all about me. I don't feel good. I want some medicine. And he told me my cousin shot himself. And it dawned on me that he was trying to tell me for like 20 minutes he was trying to tell me my cousin killed himself. My cousin was in the program. He was in the AA biker club. My family wasn't really like aware of it, but I knew it. And he had relapsed. And it was so bad that the guilt and the shame was too much for him. And our suicide rate is high, and it's because it will take you further, faster, and the guilt and shame is so incredible. It is so incredible. And that's why our suicide rate is high. It's understandable. It is understandable. In that moment, though, it was just earth-shattering for me because all I was doing was sitting there talking about me. And all I did was want him to hear about me and, oh, the woe and, oh, how hard it was. And when he told me that, it just, something opened. And I thought, man. I've been sitting here talking all about me, and my family is suffering. My family is in pain, and that just got me. And the other time was when it was in 2014. I'm driving down the road, and after you do the spiritual walk of hope, faith, honesty, courage, integrity, willingness, humility, brotherly love, justice, perseverance, spiritual awareness, and service work, you will hear the voice of God when you become willing, and it will become abundantly clear what it is. I used to mess it up. I used to convince myself, oh, I heard God's voice. And that always led me to, you know, some kind of destructive pattern. But I heard God's voice driving on 235, and it was, prepare yourself. And 6 weeks later, my mom told us she was moving to Florida. And I'm having a bad day. And the kids are, you know, in the back, and they're, you know, loud. And we'd been out shopping, and, you know, shopping with three kids when you're single is not always the easiest thing to do. And she says, I want to come over and tell you goodbye. And she had left several other times a couple of years before that. And I was just like, I don't want to go through another goodbye, Mom. She's like, oh, just come over. And something came over me. I'm okay with saying it's the Holy Spirit now. But there was this stillness. And I said, I put all me aside, all of my I had a bad day, the kids this, all my gunk, and said, okay, come over. She came over a couple hours later, and we had the best time. It was just, I was in the moment. I was in the right here, right now with her. We laughed. We played games. We hugged. And I got this overwhelming feeling when she was about to leave. I said, Mom, I don't want you to leave. I have a bad feeling about this. I think this is the last time I'm going to see you. And she hugged me. She said, baby, I'll be back. I'll always be with you. I was almost 10 years sober. And she said, I'll be back for your 10 years. And she said, besides, I'll always be in your heart. And she died 3 years later. And in that moment, when she called me, and I have kids in my ear, and they're screaming, and I'm hot, and I'm sweaty, and I'm thinking all about me, there was one split second, I could have said no, and I would have had the biggest regret of my life. But the Holy Spirit came over me, and I said, okay, praise God. And I promise you, the more you come and sit in the seat, the more you will have life. You will be blessed with those situations. You will be blessed with perseverance. You will be blessed with courage. You will get the opportunity for brotherly love. You will get the opportunity to have justice. You will get the opportunity for integrity. But the difference between me and somebody else out there was the degree of my willingness and the degree of always making myself stay honest, always that spot check. And as a result of all of these steps, what I have learned over the years, I used to not have really a purpose-driven life. You know, you hear all those self-help things. But really, the purpose-driven life for me is I was chosen. I was chosen. All those things, thank you. All those things that led up to me doing wrong, I have the opportunity to undo those. Not quickly. It's sometimes slowly, sometimes, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But they were always materialized if you work for them. I'm one of those people. You are. They will always, I can't take a big dose of a big drink of water out of a fire hose, you know. That's like somebody trying to explain the Bible to me. Because it was too much for me. It was too big. It was too vast. Because I was so bad in my mind that I couldn't. And God led me to AA so I could sort some things out. And when I was willing, he led me to a group of people that were loving and shared their knowledge of what Christianity really was. And that changed my life. And a long time ago, I became willing to be spiritually develop. And I've had people say, well, you know, teach me about emotionally growing up. I can't teach you about emotionally growing up. I just can't. I can teach you that, or I can show you that the more you spiritually develop, the silent gift is you will grow up. You will emotionally grow up. It's one of the promises. We will intuitively know how to handle things that used to baffle us. And along that lines, I was able to write my mother's eulogy. I was able to write my mother's obituary. And all of my stuff, if I'm thinking about all my pain and, oh, my mother died, I wouldn't have been able to achieve that. But in those moments, you guys taught me the pause. You taught me the moment where I could go, woof. Whether it's steps 1, 2, or 3, or I jump right to step 11, and I jump right to step 10 and do a spot check and go, hey, what's your behavior? What's your thinking right now? Put it all aside and do what God has put in front of you. And that's how I had to start living my life, is, hey, put all me aside and start doing what God intended for me. And as a result of all these steps, I was chosen to practice these principles in all my affairs. I didn't know for the longest time, probably until the last 7 years, what the principles were. And I couldn't practice the principles in all my affairs if I didn't really know them. And so I started really looking at those principles. And the principles were the guides and the natural things that my kids, because they're not using, have gained by naturally growing up. But I didn't gain those. I didn't gain honesty. I didn't gain faith. I didn't gain hope. I didn't gain perseverance. Perseverance, I had no idea what that even meant. And if it was left to me and my own devices, I would operate in my emotions. You know, I have a lot of emotions, and that's one of the things that you guys have taught me, is I have a big emotional package. But that is not a bad thing. What I had to learn was how to manage that, because I used to function based on my emotion. I'm tired. I need to go get, you know, a bump. I need to go get high because I'm hungover. I don't feel good. I'm going to stay in bed. And in order for me to do the next right thing, I kind of had to put all that aside. And when I sobered up, it was so simple. It was just do the next right thing. I had to shower every day and get to work, and I thought that was a big achievement, just to get to work and not lie and tell my, you know, I had so many ants that died when I was, you know, out there using. I couldn't keep track of all the lies that I had. So it was very key to me when I did my 4-step, And it says a moral inventory. It doesn't have necessarily all my resentment list. It's a moral inventory. I had to go discover all the things that I had done wrong. I became a lie, a thief. And the first couple of years of sobriety, I was fake and phony probably. If you really want to know it, I was just doing lip service. That's hence why I relapsed. You know? As a result of you people, I have been given all of the promises and then some. And at any point in time, I can live on the principles. I can do a spot check. And God didn't take me through the path. I took myself through the back alley. I chose to, you know, relapse. I chose to go use for 14 years. I did that. I am so grateful I stayed alive. There were times where I shouldn't have been. We did stupid stuff. We did really stupid stuff. You know, I made poor decisions. But he kept me alive because I'm supposed to answer the calling. Every one of those steps taught me to think a little bit less about myself and a lot more about you. And once I started doing that, I could see you. And it allowed me to become loving, and it allowed me to become vulnerable, and it allowed me to understand my purpose. It's my 12th step. My 12th step. I don't know what God intends for me every day. I know that the day that Troy called me a year and a half ago, that was a part of my calling. I was willing, and I have become willing. I don't know what he intends for me tomorrow. The fact is I suit up and show up. You taught me how to be a lady. You taught me how to be God's child and to embrace it. You taught me how to forgive myself. And you taught me that as a result of all of these steps, I was chosen to carry the message. And I don't know what that message is, but I'm willing to do it every single day. And the last thing I want to talk about is sponsorship. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful experience. I have a lot of sponsees that, you know, it's kind of lip service, like, oh yeah, Heidi's my sponsee or sponsor. And that's okay. Just because you don't utilize me, it's okay. I'm here for you. I'm here for you when you're ready. And I had a lot of friends go out and relapse, and I've had a lot of friends that have overdosed as a result of relapse. And my job isn't to go save you. My job isn't to keep my sponsee sober. My job is to love you through the process, like it was given to me. And had somebody not loved me through the process, I would not stand up here today and be the person that I am, because they showed me what God was. They gave me the God of their understanding, and I got to develop it from there. And sponsorship for me is just, it's God's beautiful friendship, and it's the best blessing. I'm not your authoritarian. I'm not your mother. You don't got to work the steps. I'll be here for you when you want to. If you go relapse, you can still call me. I don't fire sponsees. I don't believe in that. It's just not me. And we have a conversation, and you want to go work with somebody else, that's great. I used to take hostages. I took everybody as a hostage. Anybody that had to leave my life, you had to leave it with claw marks because I couldn't let go of you. And I don't operate in that manner. You need to leave my life, and I need to leave yours. That is just fine. That is okay. Not everybody is supposed to stay in my life all the time. It's just life. I had to get to that level of acceptance. But I've had the most joy in watching sponsees grow and change as a result of me sharing a message. And it's really me sharing a message of God and how I did it. And the easiest way to do that is I had to keep things simple. And now, you know, my spiritual understanding is really complex. I'm a big God person. I'm a big prayer. I'm a big meditator. And I hope what you see in me is love. And I'm always here for the suffering alcoholic. I'm always here for me to pass on a message that you don't have to use anymore. And here's how we do it. And had I not been walked through the steps, I wouldn't have a purpose. And for that, I am eternally grateful. And that's all I've got for today. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Give me a hug. Good. You were very good.